In collective organizations, prevention must be considered an essential measure for the preservation of internal peace. We, in the Astral City, are over 1 million people devoted to superior designs and to our own moral improvement. Would it be charitable to allow our colony to be invaded by millions of rebellious spirits? So there must be no hesitation in the defense of the common good. I know that many of you have the great crucified one in mind at this moment. Yes, Jesus gave himself up to a mob of rioters and criminals for the sake of redemption, but he did not hand over the world to disorder and ruin. We should all be ready for individual sacrifices, but we cannot give up our dwelling place to evildoers. Of course, our essential task is of confraternity and peace, love and assistance. It is obvious that we consider all evil as a waste of energy and all crime as a disease of the soul. Yet, we must bear in mind that the Astral City is a divine patrimony, which we must protect with the best energies of our hearts and souls. That which we cannot preserve, we are not worthy to enjoy. Therefore, let us prepare legions of workers to go on missions of fraternal love to Earth and to the lower zones and the regions of darkness, teaching, helping and comforting. But, we must above all organize, here in this ministry, a special legion of defense to safeguard our spiritual attainments within our vibratory frontiers. He went on in this way for a long time, stressing the importance of certain essential measures to be carried out, expounding deep considerations, which I would never be able to reproduce here. He finally closed his address by repeating the verse from Matthew which he had used to begin with, and again invoked Jesus' blessings on all his listeners, so that none of us should receive the divine benefits in vain. Moved and fascinated, I listened to a hymn, which Minister Venerandu had named the Great Jerusalem, sung by the children. As the governor stepped down from the lectern in an atmosphere of renewed hope, a gentle breeze, perhaps from distant spheres, showered wonderful, blue rose petals on us all, which melted away as they touched our foreheads, filling our hearts with intense joy. Chapter 43, An Informal Conversation. The festive atmosphere still prevailed at the Ministry of Regeneration despite the departure of the governor and his closest advisors. There was much talk about the ceremony just over, and hundreds, in response to the appeal of our spiritual leader, were volunteering for the strenuous work of defense. I sought Tobias to consult him about the possibility of my following their example, but my generous brother smiled at my innocence and said, "Andre, you are just beginning a new job. Don't be in a hurry to ask for more responsibilities. The governor has just told us that there will be work for everybody. Don't forget that our chambers of rectification are centers of active work both day and night, and that as 30,000 workers will be detailed for permanent vigilance, there will be great gaps in the rear guard which will have to be filled somehow." Perceiving my disappointment, my kindly companion added, good-humoredly, after a short pause, "Cheer up. You can always enroll yourself in a course against fear. Believe me, it will do you a lot of good." Meanwhile, Lysias, who had come to the festival in the delegation from the Ministry of Assistance, sought me and with Tobias' permission I followed him for a quiet talk. "Have you met Minister Benvenutis, of Regeneration?" he inquired, "the one who has just arrived from Poland?" "I'm afraid I haven't had the pleasure." "Let's go to find him, then. I'll introduce you to him," Lysias continued, sharing with me the vibrations of his great brotherly heart. "I've had the honor of counting him among my personal friends for a long time." In a few minutes we found ourselves in a large green park where Benvenutis usually worked. Several groups of visitors were talking here and there under the wide-spreading trees, leading me to the largest gathering where the minister was exchanging impressions with several friends. Lysias introduced me with kind references. Benvenutis welcomed me amiably and cordially included me in his circle. As the conversation proceeded, I noticed that the topic under discussion was the situation on Earth. "So painful, the scenes we witnessed. Accustomed as we are to peace in America, none of us had imagined the tremendous difficulties in the work of spiritual aid on the battlefields of Poland. All is darkness and difficulty there. One cannot expect sparks of faith either from aggressors or from the majority of victims, who give themselves up entirely to hideous impressions. Our incarnate brothers offer us no help whatsoever, but merely consume our strength. I must say that, since the beginning of my work, I have never seen such terrible mass suffering. And did the delegation remain there for long? One of those present asked with interest. As long as we could, replied the minister, the head of the expedition. Our colleague from assistance thought it advisable that we apply ourselves solely to the task so that we might take full advantage of the opportunity. I'm afraid we are far from possessing the extraordinary capacity of resistance of those devoted spirit workers on duty there. All the first aid service are working efficiently there, in spite of the suffocating atmosphere, saturated with destructive vibrations. The battlefield, invisible to our earthly brothers, is a real hell of indescribable proportions. Never does the human spirit show so ostensibly the conditions of a fallen soul, with all its diabolic features, as in war. I saw intelligent and cultured men apply themselves with the utmost care to localizing districts of peaceful activity to carry out what they call direct hits. Bombs of high explosive power destroy the patient labors of years. The pestilent emanations of hatred mingled with the poisonous fluids of guns render any service of aid almost impossible. However, what distressed us most was the pitiful conditions of the military aggressors. As they were cut off from their fleshly forms, most of them passed over under the influence of the forces of darkness, and ran away from missionary spirits, calling them all ghosts of the cross. And weren't any rescued? Someone interrupted. The minister answered significantly. It will always be possible to help peaceful lunatics in their home, but what can we do with the furiously insane but shut them up in an asylum? There was nothing to be done with such entities but leave them to the abysses of darkness, where they will, in due course, be compelled to change their mental attitude, and open their minds to a new trend of thought. So it's only just that the assistance patrols limit their rescue to those with some probability of assimilating help from above. Thus, my dear friends, you see that on every account our observations were sad indeed. Availing himself of the pause in the conversation, one member of the group remarked. Lack of religious preparation, my friends, declared Benvenutis, a cultivated intelligence is not enough. Man must, above all, enlighten his spirit in things eternal. All creeds are holy in their fundamentals and their representatives only carry out a divine mission when they teach the truth of God. They'll never be able to quench the spiritual thirst of civilization if they drift into political or worldly channels. Without the divine breath, religious personalities may inspire respect and admiration, but never faith and trust. But what about spirit communication? Someone asked abruptly, didn't its first manifestations take place in America and Europe over 50 years ago? Isn't that new movement continuing to spread the eternal truths? Benvenutis smiled, and gestured, and went on explaining. The Spiritist doctrine is our great hope, and in every respect the comforter for incarnate man, but its progress is still very slow. It is a divine gift, which most men haven't eyes to see, as yet. An overwhelming percentage of new adepts approach the divine source still under the influence of old religious vices. They want to reap its benefits, but are unwilling to give anything of themselves. They invoke the truth, but don't go in search of it. While the studious ones reduce mediums to mere human guinea pig, numerous believers act like certain patients who, though completely healed, believe more in sickness than in health, and never come to stand on their own feet. In a word, over there, they're after materialized spirits for the performance of transitory phenomena, whereas here we spend our time looking for spiritualized men to carry out serious work. The minister's play on words brought a good-humored response from his listeners. Our task is really astronomical, he resumed gravely. However, we must bear in mind that every man is a divine seed. Let's undertake our mission with hope and optimism, for if we do our share to the best of our power, We may rest assured that God will do the rest. Chapter 44, The Dark Regions. Adding to the happiness of this reunion, Lizzie has surprised me with his great culture and sensitivity. He played some old songs expertly on his zither, reminding me of music on earth. What a wonderful day! More spiritual joys followed in succession, as if we were in heaven. When at last I found myself alone with my kind friend from assistance, I tried to tell him of my impressions. "Have no doubt," he said, smiling, "that when we are in the company of those we love, something comforting and constructive goes on inside us. It's the nourishment of love, André. When souls join in the pursuit of some common interest, their thoughts mingle, forming centers of living forces through which, from the general vibration, each member of the group will receive his share of joy or suffering. That's why, on the planet, environment is such an important factor in every man's life. We shall always feed on what we cultivate. If we give in to feelings of sadness, we shall become slaves of them. If we are unduly absorbed by the ideas of sickness, we shall suffer their consequences. There's no mystery. It's a law of life which works for good or evil. Wherever an atmosphere of brotherhood, hope, love or joy prevails, we shall carry with us a share of those feelings. On the other hand, when we shall leave a gathering where inferior tendencies of selfishness, vanity or crime predominate, we carry the destructive vibration of those feelings." "You're right," I exclaimed. "I can see that life in earthly homes is equally ruled by these principles. Whenever there is mutual understanding, life becomes a false state of heavenly bliss, but if misunderstandings and unkindness prevail, home becomes a real hell on earth." Lizzie has agreed with a smile. I then took the opportunity to ask about something which had been puzzling me. The governor, in his address, had mentioned the spheres of earth, the shadowy zone, and darkness. I had never heard any mention of darkness previously. I wondered whether that dark region could be the shadowy zone itself, where I myself had spent several wandering in dense shadows. Weren't the numerous deranged entities and patients of all sorts from the shadowy zone in the chambers? Remembering that Lysias had given me some valuable information about my own condition on my arrival in the Astral City, I told him of my doubts and questions. With a noteworthy expression on his face, my friend explained. "We call the lowest regions we know darkness. Let's consider all the creatures as travelers in life. A few of them advance resolutely on the way towards the essential object of the journey. These are already spiritually evolved and, conscious of the divine essence within themselves, they progress without hesitating towards their sublime goal. Most, however, linger along the road. Numberless souls spend centuries repeating the same experience. While the former advance along straight lines, the latter travel along the same circular path. Thus failing, recommencing, and failing again, they are exposed to endless vicissitudes. Many will go astray in the forest of life, bewildered by the labyrinth they have themselves traced. To that class belong the millions of beings wandering in the shadowy zones. Others, because of their selfish thoughts, walk in the dark and will often fall into precipices where they will remain for an indefinite time. Do you see now?" The explanation could not have been clearer. Impressed by the length and complexity of the subject, I went on with my questions. "But what about those falls? Do they only happen on the earth? Are only the incarnates likely to be hurled into abysses?" After a moment's reflection, Lysias replied. "That is a good observation. Wherever he is, the spirit may hurl himself into the abysses of evil. However, in the higher spheres the defenses are stronger. Therefore the responsibility of the fault committed is also greater." "Yet," I insisted, "I thought that a fall wouldn't be possible except on earth. It seemed to me that the divine atmosphere, the knowledge of truth and of higher aid would be infallible protection against the poison of vanity and temptation." My friend smiled and went on. "The problem of temptation is more complex. The earth itself is filled with divine atmosphere, knowledge of the truth, and heavenly assistance. Yet so many fight destructive battles while surrounded by sheltering trees and flowering fields. Many others commit murders by moonlight, insensible to the soothing language of the stars. Others oppress the weaker fellow while hearing around them sublime revelations of truth. Indeed, the earth doesn't lack expressions of divine presence. Lizier's words sank deeply into my spirit. It is true that, in general, battles are fought in spring and summer when nature displays its treasures of color, perfume and light on the ground and in the sky, while burglary and murder are preferably committed at night, when the moon and stars envolve the earth in an atmosphere of celestial poetry. Most earthly tyrants are men of great culture who have turned their backs on divine inspiration. Although my conception about the spiritual fall had changed, my curiosity was not yet satisfied. Now, Lysias, could you give me an idea where the region of darkness is located? If the lower zone is connected with the human mind, where is this place of suffering and horror? There are spheres of life everywhere. My friend resumed, the void is merely a literary image. Everywhere there are living forces and each species of beings moves in a special zone of life. After a short pause, during which he seemed to reflect deeply, he went on. Of course, as happens to most of us, you placed the sphere of life after the death of the physical body in the zones right above the surface of the globe, unaware of those below it. Yet life pulsates in the depths of the ocean and the bowels of the earth. Besides, the spirit obeys the principles of gravity, just as do material bodies. The earth isn't only a field of action which we may disregard and misuse at our will. It is a live organization, with certain laws which will either enslave us or set us free, according to our actions. It's obvious that the soul overburdened with faults won't be able to ascend to the surface of the wonderful lake of life. We must bear in mind that free birds may rise to great heights, those encircled in dense thickets of reeds will find great difficulty in taking flight, and those tied to great weights become mere slaves of the unknown. Do you grasp my point? Lysias didn't need to ask that question. All of a sudden, the immense field of the redeeming struggles in the lowermost zones of life seemed to flash before my spiritual eyes. As if in need of carefully waiting his next words, Lysias thought and thought, and then began again. Just as we carry in the recesses of our beings the potential for good and evil, so the planet possesses both high and low expressions, with which to correct the guilty and open the passages to life eternal to those who triumph. As a doctor on Earth, you learn that a man's brain contains certain elements which control his sense of direction. Now you realize that those elements aren't really physical, but spiritual in essence. If you live exclusively in the dark, you will dim your divine sense of direction and end by hurling yourself into the shadows, for abysses attract abysses. Each of us shall reach the goal towards which he directs his steps. Chapter 45, The Music Fields. Towards evening, Lysias invited me to accompany him to the music fields. You must relax a little, André, he said kindly. Seeing my reluctance, he added. I'll speak to Tobias. Narcissa herself has taken the day off to rest. Come on. By now I noticed a singular change in myself. Despite the short time I had been working there, I felt greatly attached to the Chambers of Rectification. Minister Genesius' daily visits, Narcissa's company, Tobias's inspiring example and my fellow workers' companionship had touched me deeply. Narcissa, Celestius and I spent all our leisure time trying to make little improvements in the place, to make it more cheerful and comfortable for the patients, whom we loved with all our hearts. Considering my relatively new position in the chambers, I needed Tobias' permission to go out, so we both went in search of him. With respectful familiarity, Lysias talked to my instructor, who readily agreed. Good idea. André must get acquainted with the music fields. Patting me affectionately on the back, he added. Go and enjoy yourself. Come back late in the evening, whenever you like. All our different branches of service are well attended. I followed Lysias to his home in the Ministry of Assistance. It was a true pleasure to see Laura again, and to learn that Heloisa's devoted mother would be returning from the earth the following week. The house was filled with joy. Both the area indoors and the garden were more beautiful than ever. As we left, Lysias' mother took my hand and said playfully, "So, from now on the music fields will have one more regular attendant. Watch your heart, I'll stay home today. It won't be long before I find food for my soul on earth." We departed cheerfully. Young women accompanied Polydora and Eustatius, who were talking amiably. Lysias and I took the Airbus, and soon disembarked in one of the squares of the Ministry of Elevation. Lysias, walking beside me, said affectionately, "You are going to meet my fiancé? I've told you a lot about you." "It's funny," I observed intrigued, "that one would find engagements here as well." "Why not? Does love dwell in the mortal body or the eternal soul? On earth, my friend, love is like a gold nugget hidden among rough stones. It is so often mixed in with people's needs, desires and lower tendencies that people rarely distinguish it from an ordinary pebble." The explanation was logical. Seeing that I agreed, Lysias continued, "The betrothal is far more beautiful here in the spirit sphere because our senses aren't obscured by the veil of illusion. We show ourselves as we really are. Lysinia and I have failed many times in past earthly experiences. I must confess that most of the falls were due to my thoughtlessness and lack of control. Males on earth still do not fully comprehend the liberty that social laws grant us. Seldom do we use it to help our spiritualization. Instead, we often abuse that freedom in a slippery descent towards animality. Women, on the other hand, have had, up to now, the advantage of being submitted to much sterner discipline. In transitory earthly life, they are oppressed by our tyranny and made to bear our impositions. Here, however, we go through a readjustment of values and learn that we are never really free until we learn to obey. It seems paradoxical, but it's the perfect truth. Tell me, Lysias, have you any plans for a future earthly experience?" "Why, of course. I must increase my spiritual accomplishments and pay off my debts to the earth, which are still considerable. I believe Lysinia and I will return to the physical plane in about 30 years' time. Meanwhile, we intend to settle down very soon in a happy little home of our own." We then arrived at the music fields. Lights of exquisite beauty bathed the park. It was like a scene from a fairy tale. Luminous fountains spouted out their waters, forming wonderful designs. The sight was quite new to me. I was about to express my admiration when Lysias spoke, "Lysinia always comes here with her two sisters. I hope you will make them a pleasant escort." "But Lysias," I returned, doubtfully, considering my old marital status, "you know I am still bound to Zelier." My friend burst out laughing, and added, "Well, I never. No one is trying to encroach on your sense of fidelity. Yet I don't think marriage should make you oblivious of social life. Have you forgotten how to act as a brother, Andre?" Rather embarrassed, I also laughed. We were now at the entrance. Lysias approached the gate and bought our tickets. On entering the park, I noticed a great number of people around a graceful stand where a small orchestra was playing some light music. Flower-bordered paths extended before us in several directions, leading to the park's interior. Noticing my appreciation of the songs I heard, Lysias explained, "At the outer edges of the fields, several styles of music are played to please the personal taste of each group of those who cannot yet understand the sublime art. In the center, though, there is universal and divine music, the higher and sanctified art." Indeed, after walking along pleasant lanes, where each flower seemed to rule in its own kingdom, I began to hear an exquisite melody. On earth there are small groups that favor fine music, while the multitudes prefer their own regional music. Here, however, it was the opposite. The center of the park was crowded. I had already seen numerous gatherings in the colony, such as the festival held in our ministry in honor of the governor, but what I saw in this park exceeded everything that had previously filled me with awe. Yet the brilliance of the scene was not due to superfluity of excess of any kind, but rather to the artistic blending of simplicity and beauty. The women there exhibited refined elegance and good taste, without any excess which could detract from the divine simplicity. Boughs of great trees, different from those on earth, adorned the lovely, softly lit arbors. Loving couples lingered along the flowery lanes, while groups of ladies and gentlemen animatedly discussed lofty and constructive topics. Although I felt insignificant before that selected assembly, I also felt a silent sympathy from those who glanced at me. I heard parts of discussions concerning the physical sphere, didn't detect even the slightest trace of malice or reproach of incarnate men. They discussed love, intellectual culture, scientific research and constructive philosophy in an atmosphere of understanding and goodwill, without any clash of opinions. I observed that those of greater enlightenment lowered the vibration of their intellectual power while the less endowed tried to raise theirs. In numerous groups I could heard reference to Jesus and the Gospel, but what impressed me most was the prevailing feeling of joy in all the conversations. Nobody referred to the Master with negative vibrations of useless sorrow or unjustified discouragement. They remembered him instead as the supreme instructor of visible and invisible earthly organizations, full of understanding and kindness, but also conscious of the energy and vigilance necessary to preserve order and justice. I was charmed by that optimistic community, which seemed to be the fulfillment of the hopes of many a noble earthly thinker. Although enraptured by the music, I heard Lysias explain. Our harmony instructors absorb rays of inspiration in the higher spheres, just as earthly composers are sometimes brought to spiritual planes such as ours, where they receive melodic expressions. They, in turn, transmit those impressions to human ears, after adapting and adorning the themes with their own genius. The universe, Andre, is fraught with beauty and sublimity. The eternal and shining rays of life have their origins in God. At that moment, a graceful group approached us. It was Licinia and her sisters. Lysias put an end to his explanations so that we might welcome them. Chapter 46, A Woman's Sacrifice. A year had passed in constructive work, which had been a great solace to my heart. As I gradually learned how to make myself useful and find pleasure in serving, I became more confident and happy. Although I yearned to return to my earthly home, I had not yet been given the opportunity. When, on several occasions, I had meant to ask permission, something seemed to hold me back. Had I not received the kindest help from everyone? Wasn't I surrounded by the friendship and esteem of all my companions? I recognized that my wish would have been granted if it had been useful to me, and I decided to wait patiently. Although I was working at regeneration, Laura and Tobias constantly reminded me that Minister Clarence was still the person responsible for my stay in the colony. I often met the generous Minister of Assistance, but he never mentioned the subject. Clarence never changed his reserved attitude in the exercise of the authority inherent in his obligations. Once, during the Christmas festivities in the Ministry of Elevation, probably sensing how deeply I missed my wife and children, he touched lightly on the subject, telling me that the day was not very far when he would accompany me to the old home. Joyous hope had filled my heart, and I thanked him emotionally. Still, it was now September, 1940, and I still had not seen my dream realized. The knowledge that I had spent my time in useful service in the chambers comforted me. Our work went on uninterruptedly and I worked tirelessly. I had become familiar with nursing in the different wards, and had learned how to read patients' thoughts. I kept in touch with poor Elisa and tried my best to assist her indirectly through her struggle for spiritual recovery. But as I gradually reached emotional balance, the desire to visit my loved ones became more and more intense. My homesickness hurt me deeply. The only solace I had were my mother's occasional visits. Although she lived in a higher sphere, She never abandoned me to my fate. The last time we had met, she said she had some new plans in mind, which she would soon tell me.